Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Matt Schwartz. He's Executive Director of the South Florida Wildlands Association, an organization founded to protect habitat, wilderness, and biodiversity in the greater Everglades. Over the years, he's been involved in numerous battles over management of public lands, energy projects, habitat development, and Everglades restoration. We've talked a few times before, and today we're going to talk about black bears in Florida and threats to them. So first off, thank you for being on the program, and second, most important, thank you for your work.
Thank you for having me again, Derek. Good to hear from you.
So let's talk about black bears in Florida. And there's been some news over the past few months about a pretty dreadful hunt. But there are other problems that the bears face as well. So can you talk about whatever you want to with that?
Okay, well,
actually back up before that. Can you talk about the history of bears in Florida, too, or put that in somewhere?
Well, we'll get that in there. I think that what I'll start out with is the October 2015 hunt, which really made national, international news. It was the first time bears had been hunted since they were removed from the state's own imperiled species list, and that happened back in 2012. They felt that bears had recovered sufficiently to allow for a hunt, and there were other considerations there as well. But the Florida black bear is a unique subspecies of the black bear, the American black bear. It exists in about 7 isolated pockets spread out throughout the state. And I think for people to really understand what we're talking about, you have to picture Florida as it is today, not the Florida that was here 100 years ago or when Ponce de Leon landed here in 1513, supposedly looking for the Fountain of Youth, but Florida in 2015, 2016. We're now the third largest state in the United States population-wise. We surpassed New York, I think it was in the end of 2014. We're over 20 million people. And it's not just in the greater Miami area, it's throughout the state. So people, roads, development, agriculture have spread everywhere. And that has kind of relegated the black bear to isolated, genetically and geographically isolated pockets. At the time when they did the hunt, they estimated about 3,000. Now they've got it at about 4,000 plus. They say that the black bear population has increased. Prior to that, black bears, back when they were listed under the state's program, there was only a few hundred left. But this entire issue has tremendous controversy. If we roll the clock back, so the black bear hunt in 2015 is what got the most attention. But back in 2012, my organization, South Florida Wildlands Association, was in a heated battle with the Fish and Wildlife Commission over whether or not the black bear should be taken off the state's imperiled species program. Now, bear in mind that the Fish and Wildlife Service refused to list the black bear because they felt that the state regulations were already sufficient, that the state had it listed and therefore would provide enough regulatory protection that it wouldn't be necessary for the Fish and Wildlife Service to take that step as well. And for other reasons, they didn't think that the listing under the Endangered Species Act was warranted. But nevertheless, the state decided that, yes, the black bear had recovered sufficiently to remove it. We argued that, no, that's not the case. The black bear population is still small. That expected that with development coming, there's an important study. I'm going to segue a little bit into this. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission conducted a study in I think it was 2008. It was called the Wildlife 2060 Report. It was based on a demographic study called the Florida 2060 Report. It was written when the population was only 18 million, and it predicted that by 2060, the population of Florida would increase to 36 million people. So 36 million people living here in 2060. They predict a loss of 7 million acres of habitat, about the equivalent of the state of Vermont, that will occur during that time. And it won't all be in one place. It's not going to be one pocket of 7 million acres. It's 7 million acres throughout the state, either natural land, agricultural lands, and the public lands will be basically turned into these little floating islands of habitat. And that's the way they describe it. that the public lands in Florida, which really support the wildlife, will be these little isolated pockets surrounded by a sea of urban and suburban sprawl. Now, that's not a good situation for any wildlife, and especially not for an animal with a wide range like the Florida black bear. The leading cause of death for Florida black bears, I guess, until the hunt last October, was roadkill. One year recently, we lost nearly 300 bears. Another leading cause of death is euthanasia, which is really not a good term. The Fish and Wildlife Commission calls it euthanasia. But euthanasia is really an expression used for killing an animal that's in misery, putting it out of its misery. What they've been doing is killing what they call nuisance black bears. So when black bears become habituated to the places where people live, and that's because people are living next to public lands, they're coming in and taking them out. There were a few attacks a couple of years ago on people. Nothing fatal, but some attacks did take place, and they went into those areas and basically wiped out quite a large number of bears. So you've got roadkill killing bears, you've got this euthanasia or killing of nuisance bears by the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and now you've got hunting coming in. You're adding another 300 to the mix. So Florida black bears are definitely under attack. With the habitat loss we're expecting, we don't expect the situation to get better. We're expecting loss of habitat, and we're expecting more human bear contact.
And I just want to say, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but here where I live in Northern California, I see bears literally every day. And it is honestly an odd day when I don't see, for example, a mother and her two babies. I saw them yesterday, and I saw them the day before, and I will probably see them today. And they are not... I mean, if you have bears around, then they're going to chew on things. So as a result, you know, there's my mom's porch has been chewed on. You know, it's like this is just that's what happens with bears. They're right. But it's not – if you live in their home, then it seems to me ungrateful to get mad when they chew on a wood structure that you built in their home. That's my point. So I mean, they're not scary. It's not like, and there's only, I do know this too, that there is only one person dies in North America every 2 years from attacks by black bears. It's very, very rare.
It's extremely rare, right? And grizzlies are, they're a more dangerous species of bear, but black bears, there's a lot more black bears than there are grizzlies. It just doesn't happen that often. It does happen on occasion, but then again, people get killed by coconuts falling off of coconut trees in Florida and landing on their heads. Lightning probably kills a lot more people than black bears.
Well, automobiles certainly kill a lot more people than black bears do.
Right. So the danger factor, but what you brought up is a very good point about living with bears. Now we know from research.
What you do is what this means is you don't leave your trash outside.
Exactly.
Anyway,
exactly.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it. You don't leave your trash outside. You clean up after your barbecue. You may not be able to have bird feeders out there, because if you have a bird feeder out there, bears are omnivores. Black bears are omnivores. They're classified as a carnivore, but they don't act that way. Most of their diet is vegetarian. They eat salt palmetto berries, acorns. They eat all kinds of vegetation. They eat insects. And they'll eat a little bit of animal matter, mostly armadillos, opossums, roadkill, things like that. But the vast majority of their diet is vegetarian, but they're omnivores. They'll eat anything. Their noses are incredibly sensitive. They remember where they've eaten before. So if they've eaten one time, they're going to come back to that location again. And it is very easy, according to the research, to control that problem simply by using bear-proof garbage cans, cleaning up after yourself. Don't leave things out that are going to be attractive for bears to eat. And that will basically do a tremendous amount to get rid of the nuisance bear situation for both people and bears. The Fish and Wildlife, you know, we should go a little bit into the rationale that the Fish and Wildlife Commission used to authorize this bear hunt. Because that's really, we could talk more about habitat loss in a little bit, but it was the hunt itself, the act of killing bears, of killing bears for recreation, that really got a lot of people upset. And that's a, you know, you get into the whole hunting issue. Is hunting moral? Is it ethical? Is it right? Complicated topic. People have been hunting for a long time. But bears, they're intelligent. They're extremely intelligent. Most scientists definitely consider them to be the most intelligent animal in North America and up there on the level of primates in terms of their actual cognitive ability. So there's that issue. You know, the repugnance people have about killing such an intelligent animal. When you watch bears and you watch their behavior, I mean, they're thinking animals. They're thinking animals. They're trying to figure out where good situations are for them and making choices about what's good for them. I watched a video of a woman. The woman had been, I guess she was on the side of the Rio Grande in the, I forget the name of the national park, Big Bend National Park. And there was a mother and cub climbing a rock wall coming up from the river. The mother negotiated it fairly easily. She had much longer legs and arms, I guess you could say, for climbing. The cub was much smaller. And you see the cub going up this rock wall and using its legs to support itself and then holding on and then looking for the next foothold and moving over to the foothold and just working its way up this sheer wall. And I watched and I looked at the comment of a rock climber and said, yeah, cub did it excellently. You know, just figured out the route that it needed to do to get up a sheer wall. And that's not climbing a tree. That's not using, you know, strong claws to dig into that bark and go up. That's actually planning a route, putting its foot in the right location, going to the next place, looking around, finding another foothold. So this is an intelligent animal, and I think that's a lot of the way people feel about this is, what is the recreation in killing this animal? What's the recreation in killing this animal? My organization did not take an official position on that. I mean, we're basically working on the habitat issue, and we feel that the bear should not have been delisted because of the expected habitat loss. But there is some argument to be made and an understanding that I have for people who feel that this should not be done. I watched the bear hunt at a few of the check stations in South Florida when it occurred in October. I've been lucky enough to see several black bears in Florida in the wild. It was hard for me to look at these animals being brought in the way they were. And I'll share another video I saw from during the hunt. A lot of people were sharing videos, both pro and con, during the Facebook period after the hunt. And one of the videos I saw was of a couple of guys on the hunt. One had a gun, one had the camera, apparently. And a black bear comes walking across the trail, just kind of at a 90-degree angle from the way they're walking. He glances over, sees the two people, and keeps walking. No fear, no response whatsoever. He's shot in the side. He turns and runs towards the hunter. Hunter shoots him again, bear jumps into a canal, and he's shot again. But the thing that I saw is that the bear looked over, obviously assessing, saw people, heard people, looked over, said no threat, and kept going. He wasn't running, and he was shot. So I think that was probably the issue that got the most attention. Other animals are hunted in Florida that don't get the same kind of attention. Deer hunting, I mean, clearly fishing doesn't get that kind of a response. Turkey hunting, boar hunting didn't get that kind of response, but there was a very strong reaction to the idea of hunting bears for recreation.
One question I have about this that I actually don't know for Florida is what percentage of this hunting was trophy hunting and what percentage was meat hunting?
I'm not sure. I don't eat bear. I've never eaten a bear. I don't even know what it tastes like. I've heard it's not such a good animal to eat, but I have no idea. I mean, clearly the skin, the bearskin rug was an attractive part of the hunt.
Well, that's trophy.
Some people. I guess that's trophy hunting, but I mean, I just don't know. I don't know how much of it was people wanted the skin, people wanted the bear, wanted the meat, how much people wanted the thrill of killing a bear. I mean, that's part of why people hunt. I mean, I grew up fishing in New York, and as a kid, I mean, catching a fish was important to me. And the feeling of catching my first striped bass and then catching a very large striped bass or a bluefish was thrilling to me as a kid growing up. I'm assuming that that's part of it, was the thrill of the hunt for a lot of these folks. The Florida Black Bear, there's a Florida Black Bear Hunters Association that worked, you know, lobbied pretty hard for the delisting so that the bear hunt could take place. That's important to note, that when the bear was listed as an imperiled species under the state, or if it had been listed under the federal, it would not have been allowed to be hunted. So that listing of the imperiled species listing in 2012 paved the way for the bear hunt to take place in 2015.
So I could be wrong on this, but my understanding was that there was a public comment period on the hunt, and it was, and the public comments were overwhelmingly against. Is that true?
That's correct. That's correct.
And that's just, that for me highlights something that is something that's experienced all the time by environmentalists, is that there are these public comment periods that on some subjects are like 90% or 95% opposed to some destructive activity, but it doesn't matter. The whole public comment period was kind of a sham because they actually go ahead and do whatever the hell they want to anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that's another huge topic about the purpose of a public comment period.
I've been doing this for 25 years and I've gotten extremely cynical about it.
Yeah, but you know,
that doesn't mean I don't make the comments. I'm just saying I'm cynical about what result they'll have. That's all. In no way am I suggesting that as an excuse for inaction.
You know, we tend to look in my organization because we do litigation. So when we're dealing with something like a bear hunt or wildlife management on either the federal or state level, we're talking about generally decisions made by the executive branch of government, whether it's a state executive branch. Fish and Wildlife Commission is part of the state executive branch of government. Fish and Wildlife Service is the executive branch of the federal government. When we're putting comments in, to be honest, we're laying out the scientific rationale for our point of view. There's a very good chance when we do that, that litigation is going to follow. So at least for our organization, the purpose of putting comments in is to get our positions into the record. So if and when we do go to court and the agency says, well, we didn't know that information. Well, you do know the information because we submitted it in the official public comment period. So that's how we view public comments. Do I expect my views to be listened to all the time by the actual decision makers? I mean, when you go to these Fish and Wildlife Commission meetings in Florida, and I'm not saying anything bad about the commissioners, but it's pretty clear. I mean, A, none of them are scientists. They do have scientists who work for them, but the scientists work under their direction. During a hearing we had just before the bear hunt began, a number of us tried to get an injunction against the hunt, and the lead, Dr. Thomas Eason, the PhD who basically designed the hunt, the numbers, the quotas, et cetera, was asked, why didn't you wait until we had the full report on the number of bears in Florida? And he answered honestly, he says, the commissioners didn't want to wait. They said, do it now. He's an employee. So it's the commissioners who are making decisions. They are not scientists. I think almost all of them are developers, some of them major Florida developers. And they like to hunt and fish. And it's pretty clear when you go into that room that their values, and values are kind of something hard to argue, but their values are different than a lot of the people who live in the state. They work to promote hunting and fishing. I think that their science is off quite a bit. And I can give you other examples of that. For example, promoting a hunting season in the Big Cypress National Preserve, a part of the preserve that had never been hunted for any species. We're not talking about black bears right now. We're talking about deer, turkey, hogs, and one of the last holdouts for the Florida panther, in a situation where they knew that opening up this area to hunting was going to lead to competition between hunters and panthers for prey. And that was not well thought out. So, you know, we try to keep it on the scientific level when we give our comments in. We explain what the impacts of a decision will be and why we think it's not warranted. In this case, we made our biggest fight in 2012 when they delisted the bear, knowing that population in Florida was going to be increasing, knowing that habitat loss. I mean, their own report identifies 2.5 million acres of habitat loss for black bears. So how did they, and we know that the roads are increasing, so we know roadkill's increasing, we know that nuisance bears are increasing, killing of nuisance bears is increasing, and habitat loss is increasing. Food supply is going down, unless people are actually feeding their neighborhood bear garbage, and bears are smart. So the whole combination tells us that at the very least, they should have, first of all, get involved. I mean, if I was talking directly to the Fish and Wildlife Commission, what I would say is, hey, get your scientists involved in all the land use decisions coming on board in Florida. Send your representatives to county commission meetings when a development is up for discussion and explain to them what that's going to do to the local wildlife. Institute, get the bear-proof garbage cans instituted. Get wildlife crossings under the roads. If you're going to build a road through habitat, at the very least, make sure that wildlife can cross it. None of that is happening in Florida. I mean, you really have to live down here and see it. I mean, see this state experiencing one of its many land booms. We're in the middle of it. Development is everywhere, and a lot of it is in the habitat.
So that seems like a good segue into another of the threats to bears and to everyone that you mentioned to me. You sent me an email a few days ago saying that the National Park Service has approved seismic testing for oil inside Big Cypress National Preserve.
That's correct.
Which is a core black bear habitat in South Florida. Mm-hmm. So can you talk – I mean, once again, you know, hunts are dramatic, and you can have dramatic photos of dead bears on a pickup or something. And that story you told about the bear just walking by, you know, like I said, I see bears every day. I'll see them 10 feet away. I mean, they're not particularly afraid of me. I'm not afraid of them. I mean, it would be for me to kill them. I could kill three of them in 2 minutes, you know, in the three shots, and they'd be three dead bears.
Right.
This would not be, quote, sporting, end quote. But that's really dramatic. But also when you talk about, that's not really where the real action is in terms of actual threats to any creature. It's rarely, sometimes, but not very often, is it actual direct killing. I mean, habitat loss is everything.
Right. I mean, in earlier times, before we had any kind of quota systems, regulations, et cetera, I mean, we had indiscriminate hunting, yes.
Passenger pigeons, great example.
Passenger pigeons, but also black bears were down to a few hundred. Alligators in Florida were on the federal endangered species list. They had almost been hunted to extinction. The Florida panther was almost hunted to extinction. I mean, at one point they were giving $5 bounties if you brought in a dead panther. And they were wiped out. I mean, almost, if you think about it, in the entire eastern United States, there are no cougars. There are no, you know, pumas. Let's use the word pumas. I get into trouble now with the word cougar. It's become a different word. So I'm going to switch to the word puma. But there are no pumas left in the eastern United States. Sometimes a rare sighting of a puma from the western states, from North Dakota, South Dakota, making their way. There's been some sightings recently in Tennessee. But for the most part, the puma was wiped out in the eastern United States by hunting. And then secondarily by habitat loss. The two kind of went hand in hand. So now the only puma population in the eastern United States is the Florida panther, relegated to a tiny little portion of its home range in southwest Florida. But I think you're making a good point about how, as we know, if it bleeds, it leads. So a dead black bear on the ground with a gloating hunter and his pickup truck and gun next to it is going to send out a very visceral image to certain people. I wish that people would have that same recoil, that they would have that same kind of, you know, distaste when they see a road going in to habitat in South Florida or anywhere in the state or anywhere, basically anywhere in the United States right now, that we're in a position where things aren't the way they used to be. And people that love wildlife, that care about wildlife, need to be thinking. I'm not trying to criticize people. I mean, there are people for whom the hunting issue is a big thing. I don't want to pass judgment. But I wish they would extend that feeling towards the habitat itself, which sustains the wildlife. And part of what's sad about these kinds of conflicts is it's pitting two groups of people, let's say hunters, wildlife watchers, wildlife lovers, who all should be at least on the same page with regard to habitat.
Absolutely.
And habitat protection. And it's painful. You know, when I was doing my fishing in New York, I don't think I thought about it that much. But at a certain point, I did. I mean, I was a kid growing up. I was catching fish. I learned how to catch fish. I read a lot of books about it. I studied it. I talked to tackle shop owners. I learned at a very young age about the species that I was going for and how the best way was to catch them on a hook. But at a certain point, that led to an understanding of habitat and the needs of the species that I was going after. And I think that in Florida, we just don't have enough people out there up in arms about habitat loss. It's incredible. When we talk, let's talk about the black bear in South Florida, which is the region I most know. So the estimate, I think, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 500 to 800 bears in South Florida. That's from the Lake Okeechobee south all the way to Florida Bay, from Naples, Fort Myers on the west coast, all the way to the Miami, Fort Lauderdale area on the east coast. A pretty big area.
That's by the way, let's just talk for a moment about, you know, you said, what is it, 3,000, 4,000 bears total in Florida. There's 500 there. That is just a completely trivial number. That is a
compared to 20 million people, absolutely trivial.
And even though they're a large predator, I recognize they're omnivores too. Even though they're a large creature with a large range, that's still a very small number who could suddenly be wiped out by one bad virus or something. I mean, that's a very small number of creatures does not leave room for any catastrophic event.
No, it doesn't.
Go ahead.
I'll just say, A, we do believe they're still vulnerable, which is why we're arguing that they should not have been delisted from the state. But myself, South Florida Wildlands Association, joined a petition spearheaded by the Center for Biological Diversity, where we have now petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to put the black bear on the federal endangered species list. So we agree with you that the species is still vulnerable and deserves to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, probably as a threatened species, which could become vulnerable to extinction in the future, but we definitely think it warrants that listing. But where were we? We were talking about the habitat loss.
South Florida habitat loss. So 500 population.
Right, and we were talking about the oil situation. So when we were preparing the petition, I basically surveyed, worked with some other local environmentalists, and did a kind of a survey of projects going into the black bear habitat. Now, in that area that sustains 6 million people, Fort Myers, Naples, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Palm Beach County, 6 million people, more than that probably live there, and millions more visitors every year, we've got 500 to 800 bears. Projects going in, just last Friday, Wednesday. So last Friday, we got a announcement by the National Park Service that they approved seismic testing for oil on 70,000 acres inside the Big Cypress National Preserve, driving monster trucks, 60,000 pounds each, crisscross through the preserve to figure out where oil pockets are. After they do that, if they find oil, which we expect they will because there is oil in that area, in comes roads, pads, oil drilling rigs, water wells, injection wells, possibly fracking, 24/7 drilling lit up across 70,000 acres. The company that got that 70,000 acre permit has also leased a total of 235,000 acres inside the Big Cypress National Preserve from a company called Collier Resources, and they will expand that 70,000 acres to probably the entire lease area before they're through. That's one project. The same company, well, a different branch of the Collier companies, owns a gigantic piece of land right next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, which they're trying to turn into Rural Lands West, a major development, new housing, new roads, lots more people, lots more traffic. There's about 14 projects that we've identified, a sand mine, road widening projects, about a dozen new residential projects. Florida Power and Light wants to build the biggest gas-fired power plant in the country, the Hendry County Clean Energy Center, just north of the Big Cypress National Preserve. And just recently, about a month ago, they added 2,000 acres solar farm in that same vicinity. So they want to build the biggest gas plant in that area on 4,000 acres that they purchased, and an additional 2,000 acres will be turned into solar because, of course, they want to show that they're doing something green for the environment. But that will be 2,000 acres of habitat loss just in that project alone.
So 6,000 acres is almost 10 square miles.
I guess. I'm not good at...
Yeah, 640 acres per square mile.
Well, okay, right. So you talk about...
That's a lot. That's a lot of land.
Yeah, well, FPNL originally bought 3,000 acres. They were going to put the gas plant there, And the Seminole tribe objected, so they said, well, okay, we'll move it. So they bought an additional 4,000 acres to build the gas plant, and they're going to turn the other 3,000 acres into a solar farm. And that is very, very good. It's primary panther habitat. It's also primary bear habitat. All the projects I'm talking about are inside the primary zone of the Florida panther and the Florida black bear in South Florida, which right now sustains 500 to 800 bears. It's just, you know, it's an intolerable situation that our regulatory agencies are not stepping up to the plate and making the choices that they need to make. You know, they're basically saying that this is a voluntary, you know, we hope that landowners will take care of their land so we have wildlife in the future, but if they don't, it's going to be tough. And they're not saying no. I mean, they don't seem to have that word in their vocabulary, no. You know, you're crossing a line. This is not sustainable. The panther gets more, I mean, the panther and black bear are basically overlapping in South Florida. I talk about the panther a lot because the panther is at least nominally protected by its endangered species listing under the Endangered Species Act. But as you can see, all these projects that I mentioned, each one of them is going into habitat, primary or secondary occupied habitat for the panther. So the black bear, with no legal protections at all anymore, is barely being noticed. And of course, it's going to create more roadkill. It'll be create more nuisance bears, more habitat loss, more loss of food, everything bad all around.
You know, I don't think I've told you this. I have said this in public before, that the way I really got politicized environmentally was when I was about seven in second grade. A subdivision went in next to where I lived, and I saw that the garter snakes and the meadowlarks and the cottonwoods all lost their homes.
Right.
And even though I was only 7 years old, I remember thinking, they can't keep doing this forever, or where will these others live? And I remember thinking, they can't keep doing this forever, or they will run out of room.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the language I used when I was seven. And the adult language that I put on this is that even when I was a kid, I recognized you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet. And I didn't say that when I was a kid, obviously, but that's – it was so obvious. I mean, my point is that everything you're talking about is not cognitively challenging. It's not like you and I and 20,000 other people are so smart that we were able to figure out this extraordinary thing. It's just – it's really obvious. You can't have bears without the bears having homes, and you can't have panthers without the panthers having homes, or alligators, or damselflies for that matter. You know, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Everybody needs a home, and it shouldn't surprise us when you destroy their homes that they die.
Well, you know, the image that I have, and it's a hard, you know, it's like we said before, that the image of a dead bear in the back of a pickup truck is powerful. But what I picture when I see habitat loss is I see animals walking away. I remember seeing a development go on, I think it was Atlantic Avenue in Broward County, and it was right adjacent to a county park, Fern Forest Park. And there was a strip of land north of the park that I always thought was part of the park until suddenly it started becoming a subdivision. And I remember driving by it and seeing a red-shouldered hawk on a power line at the edge of the property, just looking in. And I was saying, you know, what is a red-shouldered hawk doing? Well, you know, he was just looking into his habitat and saying, what up? You know, I lived here yesterday and now I don't. So what do wildlife do when we develop their habitat? They just walk away. You know, they walk away. They don't send in comments. They don't sue. There's nothing they can do. They just walk away and try to find somewhere else that will sustain their life. And sometimes they're lucky and sometimes they're not. And sometimes in the case of a panther, a displaced panther moves into the habitat of another panther and the other panther kills them because they're solitary animals. They don't accept, you know, well, we'll take you in as refugees, you know, as habitat refugees. It doesn't work that way. Panthers are territorial animals. Bears are more accommodating, but they still have a social arrangement. I mean, but the general picture that I have of wildlife encountering habitat loss is just quietly moving away and trying to find somewhere else that will allow them to live out their lives. It's just not an easy thing to do.
Or, and this brings up something about the whole nuisance bear idea too, that just kills me, is that you wipe out their primary food sources and then you get mad at them when they eat your garbage. It's like, what are they supposed to do? You've destroyed their habitat, so now they're actually just coming back home.
Well, the people who live in these communities, though, are generally clueless about this issue. I mean, it's not, you know, when you say you destroyed the habitat, well, the person living in that house didn't do it. It was the, you know, you.
I was thinking the collective you.
Well, the collective you, but I mean, it's good to talk about who's really doing this. I mean, it's not, I mean, I'm talking about the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Fish and Wildlife Service. In some cases, in the case of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, yes, some of the commissioners are, in fact, developers at the same time. Many of them are. But in general, the decision makers are not the same people who are doing the development. I mean, what you've got is property that's owned by private owners. In many cases, in Florida, private property ownership is not old. Most of this land was federal land. It was turned over to the state around 1850. The state sold it off. I just learned this morning that the entire island of Miami Beach, just learned this morning, it was bought in 1870 for about 25 cents an acre. So anybody who's been to Miami Beach has been to that island. It was sold in 1870, not that long ago, from the feds. Of course, the feds got it from originally, I mean, the Indians who were living down here, but that's a whole different story. So private property ownership, if you trace it back in Florida, it's not generally very, it's not a very long history. Went from land that was taken from the Spaniards, taken from the Indians, taken from the federal government, gave it to the state, turned over to developers. Developers own land. Some of them have owned the land from the beginning. Sometimes they bought it from ranchers, farmers, homesteaders, whatever. And they bought it for the purpose of development. And they go in and argue, well, this is our property. We have property rights. We deserve the right to be able to do with our property as we see fit. Here in Florida, I mean, that's what happens. County commissioners regularly, change the zoning on property from agriculture to residential. I mean, they view agricultural zoning as kind of a transition zoning and just flip it over to some kind of another use. And for citizens and for little organizations like South Florida Wildlands Association to try to challenge each one of those land zoning changes. And I've done it. I mean, I've gone into county commission meetings and argued, you know, I said, what about the wildlife? And they look at you like, you know, my feeling is I could have stayed home and talked to my refrigerator and gotten a better response. I mean, they listen, but are they going to not listen to a developer who may have given them campaign contributions, standing there with his lawyer on one side, his architect on the other, with all his maps and all the planning, and saying, look, you know, we will do this in an environmentally sensitive way. I learned the word the other day. I was watching a commission meeting, and I heard a developer talking about the plant palette. Have you ever heard that expression?
No.
The plant palette. So a developer goes into a property and the palette of plants, it's like an artist has his color palette. Well, developers have plant palettes. So they talk about what they're going to plant here and where they're going to plant here. It's the plant palette of the development. I just heard that word term yesterday for the first time. So these guys, people go in and clear everything and then start planting things and making it look pretty. But a row of sable palms along a road is hardly habitat for wildlife.
So what is the, you know, you've mentioned the seismic testing, the hunting. What are other threats to black bears? And then after that, the question is going to be, what is the short-term prognosis? And then we'll ask about the, and then I'll ask you another question.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're talking about threats to black bears right now, what are the threats?
Yes.
I think we've covered them, and I think it's loss of habitat is by far number one. Roadkill is number two. Continuation of the hunt, another 300 bears killed per year. Those three are the largest causes of death for Florida black bears. The prognosis, given the willingness of Florida regulatory agencies to continue okaying green lighting development and oil exploration and mining, golf courses, universities, airports, ports, everything else that's coming into Florida, the prognosis is grim. We have a possible, you know, we're considering, it's hard for me to really get into the details right now, but we're considering some litigation dealing with cumulative impacts, for example, on the Florida panther, because it does have the protection of the Endangered Species Act. We're considering some litigation that might get into that area. But I think that unless we get a population, you know, when I was talking before about who's to blame, the people who move into these developments, people coming in here, retiring here from out of state, moving into Florida from other countries, have no clue about these issues that we're talking about. They're not even really clued into the water issue, which will affect them much more directly. I mean, they can live, I guess they never thought about black bears before, and they feel like if the state didn't have black bears, it would be no loss. Most of the people who live in Florida have no clue that we have black bears in the state. They're surprised. I think a lot of people were surprised when we had the bear hunt last October that there was even black bears to shoot. Most people have never seen a black bear. They've never been out to the woods where they could even see bear tracks or bear scrapes. The other stuff that bears do. But they're not clued into it. What will possibly affect their future is the water situation. As sea level rise increases, you know, the canals that were dredged, most of them were dredged in the 40s, 50s, 60s here in South Florida that allowed all the development to happen in our area. They have to flow. They have to flow into the Atlantic, into Biscayne Bay. The only way they're able to flow is if the level of the canal is higher than the level of the ocean. The oceans rise, those canals don't flow anymore. They're already putting pumps into the canals to get the water out of the canals and into the ocean. So there's going to be drainage problems. Bigger than that is we're losing our freshwater aquifer. The Biscayne Aquifer, which supplies all of Miami-Dade, Broward, other aquifers on the West Coast, they're subject to saltwater intrusion. And that problem is getting worse. So the long-term prognosis for Florida's freshwater aquifers, especially here in South Florida, is very, very bad. That's liable to change things. But it doesn't seem, you know, when you look at coastal development in Florida right along that area that scientists are saying are going to be inundated, it's not stopping. It's not slowing down. It's almost like this comic tragic opera that's going on here to see who wins or who dies out first. I often tell people who raise, you know, climate change, you don't hear me talking that much about climate change because my own assessment of habitat and wildlife in our state of Florida is that Florida's wildlife, especially the wildlife in South Florida and the greater Everglades, will be lucky to reach climate change. They're going to, you know, they're disappearing from old-fashioned habitat loss, habitat fragmentation, degradation, lack of food. It's not good. It's not a good situation for them. So
we have about probably 4 or 5 minutes left. And when I've interviewed you before, one of the things I've asked at the end is, you know, what can people do? But and you can answer that if you want. But what I'm really interested in hearing is what is your story? I mean, you obviously are working very hard, and there are a few other people, and there are, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of people across the country and across the world who are working pretty hard, which is nothing compared to how many are working very hard to destroy things. How is it that, what can you say to somebody who's 15, 16, 21 to help them? The big distinction is not between those who believe we need to bring down civilization and those who believe that we don't. The big distinction is between those who do something to protect the land and those who do nothing. So what can you say to people to help them get off their butts and actually do something for the land where they live, whether it doesn't matter whether they're in Poughkeepsie or Macon or Honolulu or Dade County? You know, what is it what can you say to them to help them actually start doing something?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a good point to raise. I mean, when I talk about this stuff, it could sound very grim, and people...
Well, it is very grim.
It is grim. But, you know, we've had a lot of victories. I'm not really talking about all of those. We've had a lot of victories. We threw out an oil company that had leased 115,000 acres in the greater Everglades a couple years ago, and we just stopped the fracking bill in Florida. You know, not just my organization working with many allies and activists, but these things are possible, and they're possible whenever people just get together and say, we don't want it. Elected officials are my experience has been pretty easy to move. They get voted on, you know, they come up for election, and they don't like negative feedback in their email boxes, on their telephones and their fax machines. Elected officials can be swayed, but they need to hear from people. They need to hear that anger. I mean, we're in a presidential election right now. South Florida Wildlands doesn't take any positions. We're 501c3. We're nonpartisan. But I would hope that people paying attention to this election will be asking the candidates questions about, well, what about wildlife? What about public lands? What about clean water? What about quality of life? We went through 8 years of the Obama administration, and yeah, I mean, he said a lot of the right things, but he approved lots and lots of new oil development, coal, gas, pipelines, offshore oil drilling. We just had a lease of several million acres in the Gulf for new offshore oil drilling. So he was saying good things, but, you know, this decision in the Big Cypress, opening up the Big Cypress to seismic testing for oil, that's federal land. That's directly under the Department of Interior, National Park Service. Obama could have said, hey, not a good idea. We're going in a different direction. But they won't do that because I don't have the money to go up to Washington, D.C. and do the lobbying that energy companies and developers can. I don't have a lobbyist. I mean, I'm my own lobbyist. So, and if I go up there, it's not that I can't drive up to Washington and stay with a friend and do some lobbying, but for the time I'm up there, I'm not doing my work down in South Florida. So we don't have pockets. So one thing people can get involved. They can get involved and they can just, anytime an issue comes up that they're concerned about, they should be contacting at the very least their own elected officials and making noise. Because those elected officials, if they hear enough, they respond. Number two, they can support organizations like mine. I mean, one of the things I ask people to do is join my Facebook page. Go to South Florida, you know, go to facebook.com/South Florida Wild. Like our page. People in South Florida, the administrators, directors, National Park Service people, Fish and Wildlife Service people, the decision makers follow that page. Having a lot of people on that page saying things, commenting, liking, sharing means something to them. They can also support us financially. I mean, that's the reality. I don't like to ask people for money. It's not something I do easily. But I'm doing it now. I mean, for the people that might be listening, go to our very primitive website, which we are continually saying and trying to improve to get more of our information out there. But everything is on Facebook. It's just not in an easily findable way. It's also online if you search us out. But providing support for an organization like ours allows us to do this work. If we want to litigate, that costs money. I mean, I have lawyers that like what we do and support us, but they can't work for free. Lawsuit costs me between $50,000 and $100,000. That takes money. We get other organizations to come in, but it's always a struggle. So if an organization like mine had deeper pockets, it would be easier for us to challenge bad decisions when they come up. And guaranteed, agencies don't like to be defending themselves in court. So those are a bunch of different things people could do. Like I said, a recap, contact their elected officials. It could be their county commissioner, their state rep, state senator, federal representative, federal U.S. senator, President Obama. He has a contact form on the White House, whitehouse.gov. I mean, contact your elected officials. Tell them what you want. Provide support for agencies, for organizations like ours, and write in during those comment periods. I mean, send your feelings. I know that's pretty, I'm putting that down at the bottom because, like you, I mean, we've all become pretty cynical about these comment periods. It seems like it's just going through the list. I mean, it's required under the National Environmental Policy Act. They have to have a comment period before they make a decision, but it can often seem like they've made up this decision long ago, that they're not really looking at those comments, but still it helps to put the comments in and get it on the record. So that's some things people could do. And people have to understand, you said, well, a person who's 15 or 16 years old, I'm going to give you an analogy. I mean, doctors work emergency rooms, in environmental rooms. I feel like that's what I am. I feel almost like a doctor in an emergency room situation. The cases are always being brought in. You know, I don't grimace anymore when I see them. I'm not shocked by them anymore when I see them. Thousands of acres of habitat being turned into a golf course or an airport or something else. It's just what it is. So if you want to do this work, it's important work. It has a good effect. You can win. We win a lot of the times when we were able to get involved. And you're doing this work for species that can't do it for themselves. That's really what it comes down to. Protecting bear habitat. Bears can't do this. So if you want to protect their habitat, get involved in this work. And think about, you know, we still have millions of acres of public land in Florida in spite of everything that I've been talking about. What would Florida have looked like if we didn't have people doing this work? If we didn't have people, you know, pushing for public lands, pushing for some zoning regulations that keep the habitat that we have, it would be much worse than it is today. So anybody thinking about getting into this work of becoming a habitat activist, which is, I guess, what I am, they should do it. It's important work, and it's fun.
Well, thank you so much for speaking and acting for bears and for pumas and for everyone else. And I'd like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Matt Schwartz. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. Oh.